After I got drafted, I went down to Port St. Lucie for like a little mini camp, okay? And the mini camp was basically the new draftees versus a bunch of the players that are down there like rehabbing or doing whatever. So I faced some Latin kid and he was throwing 98 miles an hour. And afterwards, I called my dad. I was like, "Dad, I got no shot."
Welcome into another episode of Baseball America's From Phenom to the Farm. I'm your host, Kyle Bandujo. Today, I'm talking to former big league third baseman Zach Lutz, who went from Division III to the big leagues. We talk about Zach's college years, spurning major programs to go play for his dad at D3 Alvernia College, where he teamed with another future big leaguer and became a multi-year All-American. After being named the 2007 NCAA Division III Player of the Year, Zach was drafted by the Mets but got injured in his first professional game, unfortunately setting the tone for an injury-marred career. We talk about how he fought through broken bones, pulled muscles, and concussions to hit his way to the big leagues. Really enjoyed Zach stopping by. Really hope everyone enjoys this episode. Episodes of From Phenom to the Farm drop every month. If you enjoy this one, subscribe wherever you get your podcast, and go check out past interviews. And if you haven't yet, please leave a 5-star rating and a review on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. Also, make sure to subscribe to BaseballAmerica.com and the BA podcast feed for all amateur baseball and prospect news. BA is covering fall ball reports in college baseball, top prospects from Jupiter, 2026 draft prospects just dropped. It is always a good time to be subscribed to Baseball America. And with that, let's talk to Zach Lutz. All right, joining in for today's episode from Phenom the Farm, he's a fifth-round pick of the Mets in the 07 draft, former big league third baseman Zach Lutz. Zach, thank you so much for joining the show.
Thanks, Kyle. Appreciate it.
I've been looking forward to this. I wanted to start off asking you with kind of a broad question, but are great hitters born or developed or a mix of both?
Actually, a great question. I would say make sure of both. I mean, you got to put in the work, you know, but some of these guys, you know, they just are blessed when they come out of the womb, that's for sure.
So you're a guy who hit seemingly at every level you played at. You only got a short sample in the bigs, but everywhere else you were on the ball. And then you're raised as a coach's kid. Mm-hmm. So what was your relationship to baseball like as you grew up? This is pre big time travel ball and things like that. So curious, like how much baseball you were playing and what created the hitter you became.
I think I was just blessed because my dad was a college coach. He's been a college coach for going on 39 years now. So even when I was 10, 11 years old, when I was being brought up, I was out practicing with the college team. So, you know, even when I got up into high school, you know, when the team was taking infield, outfield, I was out there on the field with them prior to the games, going through everything there. So I always felt like I kind of had a little bit of a one-up step on the other competition just because, you know, I've been playing with older guys my entire life. So that's why I even say today, like, you got the opportunity to go and play up a couple years, you know, just for a weekend or something, or practices, whatever it is, you know, take full advantage of it.
So you coach now, mm-hmm. and I'm curious, like, you know, if anyone, like, after this, if you enjoy the interview, go follow Zach on LinkedIn, where you're posting a lot about that. And I'm curious what you have tried to keep similar with how you were coached and how you were brought up versus what you might have evolved in.
I think just because a lot of people that want to play for me right now, it's because of just how I go about my business, right? How I have a standard that's set, how I hold everybody to, accountability and things like that. But for me, it's like good coaches are actually the ones that actually are out there coaching, right? They're not the ones that are sitting on a bucket and just going about the motions throughout the game. Like, I'm coaching my son's 10U team right now, and like over the course of 6 innings of a game, like, I am just completely gassed. Like, my voice is gone afterwards because you have to be moving them at all time. It's not yelling and screaming and coming down on them. It's, you know, coaching moments.
So as you finish up high school, you decide to go play for your father at Alvernia College.
Yeah.
Walk me through that decision. Did you think about, spending your time playing for somewhere else? Did you kind of look like, because, you know, playing for your dad, I'd imagine it has its perks, like obviously getting to spend that time with your father, I'd imagine was very special. But like, that's a different level of pressure when you go in and play for dad's team versus going to just try to make your way somewhere else.
Yeah, I think it was a little bit different for me because coming out of high school, I had some, interest from University of South Carolina, from Notre Dame, from Stanford. I had interest from these high level Division I programs, and at
A
that
little
time,
bigger than Alvernia College, South Carolina.
and South Carolina at that time was, top five programs in the whole country with Coach Ray Tanner. But for me, like, I don't know, my mind was always set on going to play for my dad. That's where I had all my trust in. He knew my swing better than anybody, obviously. But he did it the right way too, because even going in there, he brought in everybody from that team and said, "Listen, like, Zach wants to come here, be a part of the program here. Are you guys okay with that?" And not by surprise, everybody on the team was like, "Yeah, like we could actually use him a lot with our program." So it all worked out. I think my freshman year we went 41-6, and I was a first team All-American as a two-way. So, I mean, I was just always training. I mean, that was just my thing, even to this day, like getting up early and getting after it. And I just can't, I'm not the one to be sitting around doing nothing. Like, I got to be there because I want to be the best version of myself.
So you have that success as a freshman, and it seems like it probably accomplishes a ton of goals off the bat, like being on a 40-win team, doing that. Had the portal existed, do you think you would have been like, I've played for my dad, I've had this experience, I've really proven that I'm a dude at this level. Do you think you would have, you would have looked around?
No, I can promise you that too. Because even after that year, I mean, coming off of a year like I've had, like, and I never really talk about, my stats or anything like that. But coming off of a year like that, like I had the opportunity to go back to South Carolina or anywhere else where I really wanted to. But for me, like, I just didn't want to. I was comfortable with where I was at. I knew how much, time and dedication I needed to put in to get me to where I wanted to go. And it all worked out.
What was navigating the relationship like with your dad when he's your head coach? Because like your college head coach is a different relationship, but then like dad is also a different relationship, and you're navigating that now on like a little smaller scale with a 10-year-old. Like, did you guys have that fine line of talking as dad, talking as coach? Like, how'd you blend that?
Yeah, especially in college, it wasn't like, "Hey, Dad," it was like, "Coach," "Coach Lutz." Like, that's how it was. Like, with my son now, like, my son's not saying like, "Hey, Coach Lutz." He's my son's like only 10, so he's like, "Hey, Dad, can you do this? Can you do that?" I'm like, "Yeah." But it's different, like, as you get older and kind of go through the ranks and the whole system. But yeah, I mean, for me, my dad didn't take it easy on me at all when I was there. I lived at home, so there was some interesting talks at the dinner table at night sometimes after games. But other than that, I mean, we're fine.
Was playing professionally the goal? Like, even if you're playing at a D3 level, did you have your sights set on that next level of baseball?
Definitely. I would say it really started probably my senior year of high school. Senior year of high school, I really started to kind of get into the whole baseball and everything. And that's where it's like, okay, my freshman year going to Alvernia, it's like, all right, my goal is I want to play professional baseball. How much time and effort is it going to take in order for me to get there? Especially going to a small Division III school. But I was also blessed with one of my teammates, Anthony Recker. He was there, and he was a senior when I was a freshman. So when he was there's a lot of scouts that came out to see him play. So whenever they came out to see him play, I always performed very, very well. So that's where I think, a lot of eyes got on me, and then, little do you know, a couple years go by and we both end up playing together with the Mets and the big leagues on the same team. So it was pretty cool.
What is navigating the draft look like at Division III? Because those game, if you're playing a week, if you're playing the South Carolina Clemson series, half the seats are taken up by scouts. Were you consciously aware of when people were there to see you? Like, how often were you seeing teams, and like, how are you gauging interest when it's not this normal thing at the D3 level for every weekend scouts are there checking someone out?
Yes, yeah, sometimes, sometimes they'll be, right behind home plate, but other times, I mean, they'll be up in the stands, they'll be out in the outfield. Like, I don't know, like, the way I played the game never changed depending on who was there or who wasn't. It was always going to be, as soon as I step over those white lines, like, it's game on, and I'm going to give 110%. I'm going to sprint on and off the field. I'm going to be a good teammate. I hit a ball in the air. When I'm hitting, I'm going to run all the way. I'm going to touch second base. I'm going to do the same thing every single time. But that came from having good coaching.
What was draft day like for you? It can be a long wait to that fifth round. It's high in the grand scheme of things, but like what, how many, you know, where did you think you were going to land? Who were you having conversations with? Like, how'd that process play out?
Yeah, I mean, I had no clue, to be honest with you. I had a bunch of pre-draft workouts. I had them with the Phillies. I had, you know, at Shea Stadium with the Mets. That one I did very well. So, you know, I got to stay after with them and kind of meet Omar Minaya, Tony Bernazar, and a lot of the guys in the front office. So, had high hopes with them, but I didn't think it was going to be as early as fifth round. Especially coming out of a small Division III school, you never know where it can happen, you know, especially Division III. It could be late. It could be in the 30s at that time. There was that many rounds, but to get drafted in, I think it was on the first day or whatever it was, in the very last round of the first day. I mean, it was pretty cool.
Walk me through your first professional game, because as far as first professional games go, probably not what you were looking forward to.
All right, so after I got drafted, I went down to Port St. Lucie for like a little mini camp. Okay. And the mini camp was basically the new draftees versus a bunch of the players that are down there like rehabbing or doing whatever. So I faced some Latin kid, and he was throwing 98 miles an hour. And afterwards, I called my dad. I was like, "Dad, I got no shot."
Not what you usually see at Alvernia.
Yeah, I'm like, "Yeah, I couldn't even see it, you know? I'm like, I heard it just go zzz, right by, but like, I couldn't even see it." And he's like, "Oh, I just, you know, everything's gonna be okay, you know?" But then everything kind of just fell into place. But then, you know, after that mini camp, we broke and I went to the Brooklyn Cyclone Stadium. So that's a short season A ball. And my very first game was when I broke my foot. So I broke my foot. I got six screws put in that. And then it's like most of my career was derailed with a lot of injuries, and, you know, and a lot of freak injuries.
I was
So,
gonna say, run me down at like the first 2 years, because you get like, how much time did you spend working on baseball versus how much time did you spend just in a PT's office trying to get healthy?
So when I got surgery on my foot, I got the six screws put in my foot. So I was in a cast for about 9 months. So even there, like, I was always doing something baseball wise. That's what people don't understand, is even though I had crutches and I had a cast on, like, I was doing like the arm bike to build up my shoulder strength. And like, when I came back after all that, when I showed up to spring training the next year, everybody was like, "You look like The Rock." And I'm like, "Oh yeah, because that's all I did was just like upper body, but like hand-eye coordination drills, like all that type of stuff." So even though it was difficult for that to happen with an injury right out of the gate, I think it made me stronger mentally in the long term.
When you're in a pro organization, like, you have plenty of, unfortunately, plenty of experience in being on the injured list with a variety of things. What is that like? When you go on the IL, does like a different type of training get placed on you? Are they like, okay, you're hurt with this, we're gonna work on this, or is that all kind of left up to you of how you come back from this injury?
Well, the Mets staff, I mean, that whole organization is just fantastic. I mean, that's just top-notch organization right there. You know, they treated me like family even to this day that I'm retired from playing with them. They still treat, you know, my wife and kids like family and go to the games and everything. But being on the IL for so long, it's like you get to meet every single person at the hospitals. You get to meet everybody, you know, down in Florida, Port St. Lucie. It's like, you know, but the thing that I think always caught everybody by surprise is like, all those injuries, they never got me down. They always found a way to work with me, because I'd be like, "Oh, I'm good. Let's go. I'm good. I'm gonna go out there. Oh, you can take 20 swings today." I'm like, "20 swings? Like, I want to take 50, you know? I want to take 100. Like, I'm ready to get back there. Let's go." But the process and everything that I've gone through with all them, whenever I came back like better than I was before. So that's just, you know, comes down to my work ethic, but that's also from the staff there that helped me get to there.
How did you transition to the minor league lifestyle? Because the thing I like talking about with like fellow small school guys is we're used to cram buses, long rides, bad hotels, you know, rooming with a bunch of people, where if you played for South Carolina or if you played for Vanderbilt, like, you go from, you know, flying and getting your own hotel room and staying in nice hotels and like catered meals and stuff like that, to it's a culture shock. Did you think that like helped you coming from Alvernia into the minor leagues? Because it, in a lot, some ways, I imagine it was kind of like a step up.
A little bit, but it's not like, you know, like if you're coming from a South Carolina or an LSU and you go into, you know, some small minor league in Tennessee, and you're like, what in the world? Where am I right now? But for me, like, I wasn't like that at all. I was just happy to be there. I was just focused on the goal of getting better every single day.
What was, I guess, like, did you have any like bad living situations or anything where you're like, even, even from, I guess coming from college, like you were living at home, that's as comfy a living situation as it can get. Were there any times where you're like in one of those, this is, before they paid for housing and stuff, were you ever in like an 8-man apartment where you're like, what am I doing here?
No, never like that. I think the one thing that people don't realize with pro ball is, you kind of get thrown into the fire where, one day you're waking up in college and you're getting on the bus and you have, 15 just American guys on there with you. Next thing you know, you go into pro ball and you look to your left and there's a guy from Venezuela. You look at the guy from your right, a guy from the Dominican. So for me, I took it upon myself as like, I wanted to know every single person. I wanted to learn as much as I could from everybody's culture. Because that made me just an overall better ball player. Because as it was after my first year, I got asked to go to the down Dominican for just like a short fall, like winter season or whatever, at the Mets Academy. And it was just great to see how they go about their business. And it's like over here in the States, we take a lot of this stuff for granted. We're over there, it's like they'll be out there with, no shoes or socks on all out in a dirt field. And here we're complaining because it's a little bit hot out. Like, come on now, so it's eye-opening, but it was only for the better.
You talked about seeing 98 for the first time and things like that. And I would imagine the big step up is how you were pitched. Because at Alvernia, like I saw an article about how many, you're getting walked all the time and probably pitched around a lot and things like that. What were the adjustments you had to make in those first 2 years of pro, like things that you maybe hadn't seen before?
Yeah, just timing, kind of my setup and everything too. In high school and college, I didn't really have like a big leg kick or anything like that. So my stance and setup from when I got into pro ball, I had to change a little bit just because in high school and college, I mean, you're not seeing 98, So I needed to find some sort of timing mechanism that helped me out a little bit. So I started with the leg kick and I played my whole career with a leg kick. So that's how it kind of worked out for me.
And when you were on the field, it's in minors, like especially like that, you had a breakout year in double A, like you drove the ball with impact, but also were a high on base guy. Was that a conscious effort about your approach? Is it just kind of how things shook out for you in terms of your ability, or like, because a lot of times when guys are selling out for power, there's some downside that comes with that, especially as stuff increases. But like when you went up to the box, like what was your mission and what led to those high impact numbers, but also getting on base?
See, now we're talking about the good stuff here, where I get very passionate about, because with me, my approach was, I want to hit a line, I'm right-handed batter. I want to hit a line drive right through the second baseman, right? And with power, like right through the second baseman or right center field. Now it's like, okay, you see guys and they're doing some teacher man nonsense, or they're doing all this, collapsing the backside in order to pull the ball. It's like, for me, I always wanted to hit for a high average. I wanted to get on base and I wanted to slug too. But with all that, it all kind of came together with my approach. If my approach was like, I'm trying to get something early and often in the count that I can do some damage with and hit it to right center, well, then that's fine. If I'm a little bit early on it, it's going to be a double in the left center field gap. But if my approach was stepping up to the plate and trying to hit something poolside, I'm going to have no shot because I'm going to get off speed away all day long.
With that, as you get into the mid to high minors and you start, scouting report comes out on you, like, pitchers would obviously know like that's your approach or have kind of an idea. How did you find yourself, like, I would say like getting attacked? What would you say as you got older were the adjustments that pitchers were making on you? If you're trying to go out to right field, what did you start seeing a lot of hard stuff in? Kind of like how does, and what's like the day-to-day of I face this guy in May and then suddenly I'm facing him in August and the sequence is completely different.
Yeah, I mean, baseball is just a game of adjustments, Like if the pitchers are going to make adjustments on me, well then I got to make some adjustments too. So for me, my approach was always, right center. So if somebody, it kind of got out, okay, bury him in, get underneath his hands. Well, then for me, I need to do whatever I could to lay off that pitch. If I could lay off that pitch, then okay, I might be able to get something out over the plate. But then also, like, I would also work on that pitch too, because Evan Longoria was a guy that I looked up to a lot growing up, and I kind of watched his pregame routine that he used to do off of the tee, and he would put the tee up close, very in on him, and just keep his hands in and work low line drives to the back right part of the tunnel. So that's something I incorporate into my routine, and it just kind of helps slow the game down, and it kind of clicked for me.
Is that something that when you go up to the plate, are you like, do you have in mind, okay, if I get something, say if I'm getting like, heat in or something like that, I'm just laying off. That's not what I'm going for. Like, are there things that you eliminate that to chase or to attack as when you go up to the plate?
That's a great question, because I think the game will just kind of dictate on what my approach is going to be, right? Like if a guy is showing that he is commanding a lot of his off speed that day, well then I might not even go up to the plate and eliminate, the hard stuff right out of the gate. I might just go up there and I'm like, okay, I'm just going to sit off speed this entire at bat. But like, I think it was with all the teams that I played on, especially in the minor leagues, every single team that I played on, we always hit. And it was like 1 through 9. Like every single person on our team could just flat out hit. Play with guys, Eric Campbell, Nick Evans, Daniel Murphy, like all these guys. We were on a team together, and it's like, man, you got everybody's hitting the ball over the yard. But it's all because in the dugout too, the way we go about our business of like talking about the situations, right? It's not like you go out and watch, youth games right now, and they're talking about, video games and all this stuff that's like that. It's like we're talking about a plan and how to execute it.
I've had to ban the word Roblox in the dugout. Just drives me insane. So, talk to me about that pass back, because like you're a right-handed power hitter. Daniel Murphy's a left-handed hitter. He comes back in the dugout, or you come back. What are those conversations in between seeing pitchers?
So especially with lefties, I mean, the communication really isn't that in depth, because they're gonna pitch him differently than they're gonna pitch me. So if it's me and it's a guy like a Nick Evans or whatever who I played with, like I'm gonna be like we are gonna be spitting ideas off of each other that whole game, just because the way he's gonna attack him is probably the way he's gonna attack me, or vice versa.
Is there like a success story or something, like a nugget you have of, oh, I got a piece of information that changed? Like, what are things that you could be told as you're walking to the on-deck circle from the guy you just batted? Like, what are you looking for from that person?
AI agents are everywhere, automating tasks and making decisions at machine speed. But agents make mistakes. Just one rogue agent can do big damage before you even notice. Rubrik Agent Cloud is the only platform that helps you monitor agents, set guardrails, and rewind mistakes, so you can unleash agents, not risk. Accelerate your AI transformation at rubrik.com. That's RUBRIK.com.
So, all right, so this is when it really clicked for me. I was in double A, and this is when my power really started. Is we had a hitting coach, his name is Louis Natera. And Louie, God, thank God for Louie. If he can hear this, thank you. But for him, he just made it so simple, like with my stance and my approach. Like with me, I used to do a lot with my hands and a lot of movement and everything. So for him, he just said basically, okay, just tuck and go. And I'm like, tuck and go. I'm like, okay. He's like, just slow it down. Almost treat it like it's a 3-0 count up to the plate. So, in a 3-0 count, you can see the ball really well. And you're like, oh man, if I would have swung at that, I would have crushed it. He goes, just think that and then just go tuck and go. And I'm like, okay. So, first at bat, I hit it over the batter's eye center field in New Hampshire. And I'm like, oh my God. Next at bat, I go pull side homer on a slider that was hung. And I'm like, okay. And then it just clicked, And they're like, the rest of my whole career, it's like, man, all this stuff that I learned, all these, people that are telling me things, and like, they try to overcomplicate it. But it's just a little thing of just tuck and go, and I'm like, all right. But
As
that
you
worked
got
for
into the
me,
high, yeah, I mean, yeah, and everyone's a brother. It's like finding that one thing is crucial. Like it's I golf a lot. Like if you have that one clear swing thought, it changes things for you.
Definitely.
As you get into the high minors, like how conscious of you were you of like the business of the game, starting to look at the depth chart of who's ahead of you, what could make sense of like what's your ticket, you get added to the 40 man, like How much do guys in your position really pay attention to that stuff?
Guys do, and they do it too often. Where myself, like, I didn't think about any of that type of stuff. I mean, for me, especially with the Mets, like I had David Wright in front of me at third base. I had Lucas Duda and Ike Davis over at first base. So I just knew, like, I just need to swing the bat. If I swung the bat, they were going to find a spot for me. And whenever I was on the field, I would always hit. You know, so that's why I think I got my opportunity up in the big leagues. It wasn't a ton of time up there, but I took the most of my opportunity.
What was your focus during off seasons? Like, you finish a year, it's you've got, 3 months to become a better version of yourself for spring training. Was it focused on getting stronger? Was it trying to handle a pitch differently? Like, how would you say I'm gonna be? I always talk about, like, an MLB The Show. Your player from 23 to 24 gains 5 XP or whatever it is like that. Like, what? How would you look to gain that for yourself?
I didn't take a break. Like, when the season was over, like, I would just get right back after, because I always knew that I had that chip on my shoulder for being injured all the time. You know, if it was an injury where it was like, oh, I'm not feeling too good today, like my body hurts, like, no. If you're playing pro ball, you're playing every single day, you never once feel 100%. But there are times when you're just like, oh my God. But then, like, you just get up and you go. But the injuries that I have of, like, being in the dugout and a ball getting hit foul and came over and broke my finger, and I'm like, what are the odds? And, like, the next day David Wright went down to DL, and I'm like, I was hitting like 330 at the time, and next thing you know, he gets hurt. I get injured the day before just by a freak accident, and I'm like, you gotta be kidding me. So there are a lot of things that happen, you're just like, oh man. But once again, I never got down. My dad was always like, I never knew how long you were kind of going to go through with everything, with, kind of having so many ups and downs, but it's the way I was brought up.
After all those injuries, say 5 years into your pro ball career, 4 or 5 years, a couple IL stints, you've obviously got all those screws in your foot. Did you feel physically different? Like, did you notice a different? Because, like, in some of your BA scouting reports, it said, like, when you were in the game, you would hit, your range had slowed a little. Like, could you notice a physical difference in yourself versus the day you signed?
But without a doubt, because, like, when I signed, like, I was when I ran the 60-yard dash, like, I was running like a 6.85, and a 6.85 for 220-pound third baseman, like, is pretty good. So, and then, like, when I got that with my foot and came back, like, my side to side, my first step explosiveness, like, all that kind of took a step backwards, but I knew that I can make up for it with my bat. So that was my biggest focus, of like, keep improving my bat, keep improving the power, and then, I kept moving up the ranks.
It's often said, like, the jump from high A to double A is the biggest jump before the jump to the big leagues.
Oh,
But
without a doubt.
curious, like, what you see the difference in double A and triple A is, because you spend a decent amount of time at both. Like, what would you say, is there a day to day, is there a talent difference? Like, is there much of a difference?
I would say, I think what you said there too was, like, in high A, it's like you got a lot of good arms, but they can't really locate it that well. So if you can hit there, you can basically hit anywhere, right? Then you got to double A. Like, for double A, I think I was only up there for a total of, I think, 75 games in my double A career. But yeah, I mean, going from double A to triple A, there's just guys that are more veteran guys that have had, cups of coffee up there, or guys that are just trying to find their way back to the big leagues. But I don't know, double A and triple A kind of, for me, felt like kind of the same, but the biggest jump was from high A to double A.
And you got your first, you received the call in a pretty unique spot, if you want to tell me that story.
Yeah, it was my wife's grandfather passed away, so we were at the viewing, and yeah, I had my phone turned off, and next thing you know, I turned it back on, and I had like 150 missed text messages and calls, and I was like, what is going on here? So, I called our manager, Wally Backman. He goes, let's see. He goes, man, he goes, you got to get back here. I'm like, what's going on? He goes, you got called to the big leagues. I'm like, oh my gosh. So it turned an upset moment into a happy moment there for a little bit. So it was cool.
We're gonna get to the big leagues in a second. I did not research well enough that you had played for Wally Backman. I just need your best Wally Backman story.
Wally Backman. So we were
That's
in.
pod, I will say that is pod appropriate.
I know. No, I hear you. We were in Tucson, and like for me, like I never would get thrown out of games. I would never say anything to like the umpires or anything. I would treat them with the utmost respect. But for whatever,
That is coach's son right there.
yeah. But like for whatever it is, like I don't know. The guy just kept ringing me up, calling pitches. I'm like, dude, I got no shot right now. So I got thrown out of the game. This is like the second inning, and then next thing you know, I have the helmet come flying over, and the helmet comes flying over and hits me in the back, and it's Wally through his helmet. And I'm like, oh my God, what's going on? And he's like, come on, Lucy. He goes, let's go grab a beer, man. I'm like, this second inning, dude. What are we doing? You know? So we both got thrown out. I'm like, oh, that's all right. But Wally, like, talk about like a player's coach. Like, that dude will do anything for you. Like, he's the man.
That, I mean, he's just a legend. So,
Yeah.
walk me through that first day in the big leagues. I imagine you have to get from, the viewing or whatever, you
Yeah.
gotta the classic call up, like
Yeah.
gotta find your way there. But a couple years prior, you're in Alvernia College,
Yeah.
and now you're walking through the big leagues. Like walk me through that initial experience.
It was just surreal because it happened in Lehigh Valley, which was, right around like my hometown. So, after I got that call, I had to go back to the Iron Pig Stadium, pack up my bag. There was a limo there to pick me up, drove me to Citi Field. Got there right before the game started. Pitch hit late in the game, bases loaded with two outs, and ended up striking out. But
When
yeah,
you're
when
oh, so when you're coming up, when you're in like the on deck circle or whatever, you got bases loaded, two
Yeah.
outs, whatever. In your head, are you like, this is going to be an incredible moment or things like that? Or are you just so, is your brain just spinning so
Yeah,
much that it.
I think you're just caught in the moment, Like I wasn't like nervous or anything. Like even first pitch, like it was against the guy I faced in spring training a lot. His name's Mike Dunn, and like I'll tell everybody to this day, Mike Dunn is the hardest pitcher that I faced, a left-handed reliever from the Marlins. Because he would just always backdoor a slider on me all the time, and I'm like, I can't pull the trigger on it. So I got a first pitch fast from him, and I fouled it straight back, and I was like, that was my pitch, Because then after that, it was just slider, 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 and I'm like, all right, he got me, but it was a cool moment.
You end up with over two stints, 22 games in the majors. Amounts to like the Crash Davis, like 3, 4 weeks, things like that. How much do those 22 games change your career, like financially, how you carry yourself, your reputation, just how you generally feel about your life in baseball? Like, what do those 22 games mean?
Yeah, I mean, as soon as you find out that somebody has played in the big leagues, it's always like an eye opener, right? But for me, I'm not the type of person that goes around and, has the Mets tattooed across my forehead and saying, "Hey, I played for this." Like, most of the time at our academies, like people don't even know that I played like in the big leagues or anything, unless somebody there was like, would tell them, But there's other ones too where you see guys and you're like, yo man, like I get it. Like you played 10 years in the big leagues, but the way you're acting right now and coaching in youth sports, like it's an embarrassment, So sometimes it's those guys that just get up there or that have had a cup of coffee and some of those guys that are managers in the big leagues, that just have a little bit of time. It's like they know the game, they understand the game very well.
What's your favorite big league perk? Like the off the field perk. What was the thing, like the jumping from AAA to the big leagues? You were like, this is the good life.
Just probably the plane rides. Having a steak on the plane ride, and I'm like, oh, this is nice.
That sounds lovely. That
Yeah,
sounds lovely.
the hotels. I mean, just there's a lot of good that comes from it.
What's the difference in like how you carry yourself in a big league clubhouse when you're a rookie versus how you're carrying yourself in AAA when you're, you were never like the old guy in AAA, but like
Yeah.
a guy who's played a lot of minor league baseball, has had that cup of coffee. Like, what's the difference of how you feel about yourself in the clubhouse?
It's the respect, It's the respect that you give the ones that have played before you. And that's where you don't see a lot of that today. Like even coming up when I was in AAA and I was a youngin' in AAA, like all those guys have played in the big leagues. So in order to be around those guys, like a Justin Turner, like a Michael Barrett, I mean, there were guys there, Casey Fossum, like a bunch of these guys, like you got to give them res the respect because they were the ones that are there before you. So being in the dugout with guys like a David Wright, with like a Jose Reyes, it's like, man, you want to pick their brain. You want to do whatever it is that they're doing.
Did you feel like it was an open forum where if David Wright had an AB, you could walk over there and be like, "Hey man, I, he threw you this. Can you walk me through the scenario or what do you think?" Like, is that culture there for call-ups like you?
Yes and no. You just kind of got to have a feel for it. Because there's certain times you can do some things and there's certain times where you can't do some things. But when you've been around the game long enough, you're going to hear that phrase. You just got to have a feel.
How'd you first hear that Japan was an option for you?
That was in 2014. That was a frustrating year for me because even going into camp, spring training, like I absolutely dominated it. And then I went down to Vegas, start off the year, was killing it. Kind of realized like I wasn't really going to have an opportunity. I didn't really want to do all the whole up and down, up and down, up and down, up and down again. So Japan came about, took the opportunity, ran with it, and it was awesome. Yeah, having guys like Andrew Jones on the team, I mean, just the wealth of knowledge that guy has. So to kind of take me under his wing for that short time that I was there, I mean, it was awesome.
What are the logistics like of moving over to Japan? Is it like Mr. Baseball where you get your own translator
Yeah.
and like how long does it take to feel like I'm comfortable in the place I'm living?
Don't really know. Like it wasn't that shocking for me or anything like that because I knew like with the Mets we had Daisuke. So Daisuke Matsuzaka, like I knew him, so he had his translator over here. So I knew that I was gonna have my translator over there. My wife was with me, she had her translator with her too. So it's obviously a culture shock and everything, but I mean going out there and playing on the field, I didn't feel any different. I think I felt more relaxed because if the fans were yelling at me, and I don't know if they were saying anything bad, I didn't really understand it anyway because I didn't know the language. So I think that's why I played so well over there.
Did you find that the pitchers like sequencing was different, how they attacked you was different? Like was there an adjustment there?
Yeah, that's where I really started to see a lot of split fingers. But it's just the way they go about their business. I mean, like with how they prepare. I feel like they've been doing a lot of this stuff over there a lot longer than we've been doing it over here. I mean, even after games, we get back from the at the team hotel, and hitters would be out in the parking lot and taking dry swings and just doing stuff. Pitchers would be out in the parking lot doing towel drill, like things like we're not seeing that over here. But then, like they're just creature of habit.
What do you take from your time in Japan that when you coach now, like what are lessons learned that you can apply to youth players?
Patience. Patience is the big one because before I went over there, I didn't have patience for anything. And then being over there, and it's like it's more relaxed and how they go about their business, but there's a lot more focused on everything there. So that's how I am with my lessons here. That's how I am with coaching. Like I'm very laid back. Like that's why everybody's like, man, like the way your dad coaches and the way I coach is completely different. But I don't know. It works.
How are you guys similar and how are you different?
I think back when I was playing in college, I mean, he could get angry, And for me, like I could never really do that. But the way we go about our business and how much we care, that's how we're alike. Like if after a game, like if we lose, like we're just gonna shut down. Like and it's how I am today too. Like even if I'm coaching, like after the game, I'm like, listen, everybody, I'll have our talk with it. But then in the car, I'm just like quiet because I'm like quietly like pissed off, even though like these kids are like 10, 11. I'm like, I just hate to lose. But they know, like, listen, they know that I'm all about the development.
I've learned that it you have to like rein it in, but it
Yes.
stings no matter what level you're at. Like you lose a game and it's just like you just gripping the steering wheel tight that
Yeah.
you shouldn't have just lost to a bunch of 10-year-olds.
Yeah, and I'm looking, I'm like, you're telling me that we just went out there and we lost to this team where their head coach is coaching in baseball cleats. I do not understand what's going on here. You know what I mean? At 10U, he's got on baseball pants and cleats. Like, I don't understand.
I think like the biggest, not to just dive off your career, but I think like the biggest issue with Little League, with travel ball, with anything, is there are too many coaches, players, parents, but mainly the adults who think that this is a lot more serious than it actually is. Like
Yeah.
these games are a bigger, and that any of these kids are going to have any memories from this other than just playing baseball. If you have like vivid memories from your 12-year-old baseball team, they're probably bad.
Yeah. Without a doubt. Well, it all stems back to good coaching, you know? Like a good coach will set the standard. He'll hold like the accountability to everything. And then the parents will realize like, hey, I shouldn't be acting this way. Like the players, this is how I should be before the game. This is how I should be during the game. This is how I should be after the game. Like the coach is the one that sets that. And if he doesn't, then he's going to get walked all over. Then over the course of the weekend, the parents are going to be acting abruptly out there because they don't know any better. But if the coach says, this is what you need to do, A, B, and C, and then all of a sudden, like, hey, I'm going to do my job. You do your job. We're in agreeance. Okay. And then we go.
As you get later in your career, you've played in the big leagues, you played in Japan, you start to do that bounce around thing where you're back in AAA, things like that. Like, what keeps you going, and especially like considering how often you got hurt and the wear and tear in your body, what keeps you going year to year? Like, how often do you think maybe I should hang it up, or maybe in like next year, this year's my last year, things like that, before you actually decide to walk away?
I think it was just the passion for the game, but then I had three different concussions, and the one concussion was pretty bad, and it's even stuff that I deal with to today. That's where it got to the point where it's like I just couldn't do it anymore. Like physically right now, I can go out there and I can hit, I can do ground balls, I can still do that stuff just as good as I was when I was 21. But as far as going out there and actually like playing the game or like playing under the lights, like it's a headache.
If you had to go back and give a speech to yourself the day you signed, so you at Alvernia College, what would you tell that kid?
Get ready for the roller coaster with all the injuries. I don't know. Like, I feel like I was just so mentally tough because of how I was brought up. Like, even though going into it, you get drafted out of Division III school, you're getting thrown into pro ball. Like, it's a completely different world. So you got to be mentally tough in order to get through that, and that's how it was.
Got a little rapid fire for you, then I'll let you get out of here. Favorite minor league stadium?
Brooklyn Cyclones.
I mean, I heard nothing but good things. Do you have a least favorite minor league stadium?
That's in Valley Renegades.
What made that? What made that? That was a quick answer. What made that one the?
I don't know. There's just two people that would just sit behind home plate and they would wear these raccoon hats all the time and just yell the entire game. And that's wild because that was like my first year of playing. So just and like that always just stuck with me. I'm like, I'd never want to go back there ever again.
Are fans a bigger issue in the minor leagues than they are at the higher levels of baseball? Because I would imagine, like, at Citi Field, there's so many of them. Whereas you're like, I've done the minor league intern thing. Like, if you're at a game with 800 people and there's
Miserable.
two good hecklers, you can hear every word they say.
Yeah, big leagues, Japan, like it's obviously loud, but like you can't hear anything what's really going on because you're so focused. But you go into I don't know, you're in a high A game in Tampa and there's 800 fans and you're like, oh my God, there's two guys around the third baseline. I'm like, dude, can I just go out and play center field this game just so I can get away from these guys?
What's your favorite big league stadium?
Probably the Braves old stadium.
Oh, Turner. Is
Yeah.
that a nostalgia pull, or was it actually a good place to play?
Good place to play. Favorite player growing up was Chipper. Now my dog's name, Golden Retriever, is Chipper. But just playing there, just the atmosphere, and then with the tomahawks and everything, like it was pretty sweet.
Best pitcher you ever faced, I would say non-Mike Dunn edition, because you already.
I don't know, probably Bumgarner.
Oof.
Yeah.
Even as a righty, like what does that slot look like when as a right-handed hitter? Because he's got it, like it's got to be coming from just so far away from you.
Yeah, I think it's just the fact that like you look at him and his shoulders take up the whole size of the mound, you know? And then you look at him and he's like, this guy's gonna kill me, you know? But then there's other guys too, like Scherzer. I mean, you're like, Jesus, the guy is ready to rip your heart out, you know?
Still do,
Scherzer,
still doing it. 41 years old
Kimbrel,
and absolutely
still doing it.
psychotic.
Yep. But gets the job done.
Favorite homer you ever hit?
Probably my last at bat in Double A. We were playing against the Reading Phillies, so I don't know, just means a lot because that's where I grew up, and it was my very last at bat there, and I hit a go-ahead homer to put us ahead and win the game.
This is my go-to for Pennsylvania guys. What is the proper way to eat a cheesesteak, and where's the best place to get one?
I'm not gonna lie, I don't eat cheesesteaks.
Really?
Yes,
Like never, like never?
even like going in like to Philly now and all that. Nope, never got
No.
into it.
So what's your like your Northeast food? Are you a Scrapple guy? I know Scrapple's big up there.
Scrapple, but everywhere you go, it's just chicken parm. That's just
That's a
a
high floor food. That's like a
yeah.
prospect. Like Chicken Parm plays 8 years in the big leagues, eight solid
Yep.
years. They don't make any all-star teams, but like it's hard to mess up Chicken Parm. Last one, everyone gets this. Do you have a nightmare bus ride story from the minor leagues?
None.
Really? Not a single.
No.
I think that's got to be the D3 in you of like, this is fine. This is all gravy.
Yep, you're just like whatever. You just go with the flow.
Love that. Love that. Well, Zach, that's all I got for you. Thank you so much for joining Pavina on the farm.
Yeah, I appreciate it.
And that's it for today's episode. Big thanks to Zach Lutz for walking us through his career journey. If you enjoyed this episode, please subscribe wherever you get your podcast. And make sure to subscribe to baseballamerica.com and the BA podcast feed for all amateur baseball and prospect news. And we'll catch you next month. Thanks for listening.
AI agents are everywhere, automating tasks and making decisions at machine speed. But agents make mistakes. Just one rogue agent can do big damage before you even notice. Rubrik Agent Cloud is the only platform that helps you monitor agents, set guardrails, and rewind mistakes, so you can unleash agents, not risk. Accelerate your AI transformation at rubrik.com. That's RUBRIK.com.